Hello. Can you hear me? Okay. First things first. Let me take a picture. I got you. I want to remember this day. Anyway, when I found out that somebody had asked me to be the keynote speaker at anything, and then I found out it was this, my first thought was, Bruce Lundvall must be sick, Billy Taylor must be out of town, and where is Tommy LaPuma when you need him? Because I've never been the keynote speaker at anything. So in the strangest, obviously I'm honored, you know, because it's with people I would, you know, like to meet and talk to. But also I was trying to figure out, like, what am I going to talk about? I have absolutely nothing prepared. I have a whole bunch of thoughts, and on the way up, we drove up, Kevin Calabro, who works with me, we drove up. I said, what am I going to talk about? You know, like, what, you know, give me the thing to talk about. And he said, well, you know, jazz and radio. It happens, that's one of the few things that I'm legitimately able to talk about. So I'm going to talk about jazz and radio as best I know it from a historical perspective. When I was 19 years old, I was a junior at Temple University in the communications department, which was basically a disc jockey school, and you could actually say you went to college. I got a job on a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week FM jazz station in Philadelphia, WHAT-FM. What I had was it was an all-jazz station, and in 1961, September of 61 when that happened, when people got out of high school, a lot more people then than now got into jazz. It was kind of a music you matured into. And it was a golden age of jazz. And there was lots of stuff that was legitimate jazz that was not compromised music that also had popular appeal. So it was a function of that time. So being a jazz disc jockey was a hip thing to do, and you needed certain things. First of all, you needed a deep voice because you had to be cool. So no jazz disc jockey that I know ever got excited. He was always very in control. So we were guys like that. We sounded as phony as we actually were. But after a while, you know, that kind of disappeared. So at the end of the 6 or 7 years I was at WHAT, I was actually talking the way I really talk. But it was an interesting time in radio. And what I really wanted to be was a record producer. But I also really wanted to be a disc jockey. I thought it was a cool thing to be on the radio. Because there you are, instead of having people come to the house and you drive them nuts by playing the records you know that they need to hear, whether they want to or not, you could do it for hundreds or thousands, or if you got lucky, millions. And on days when it snowed, you know, you had even a bigger audience because school was closed and nobody could go to work, so then you could really show them just how much you knew, how hip you were, how great your taste was, you know. And you could become kind of like a mini semi deity in your hometown. The years I spent at radio were fascinating years because I was really a kid. I remember the first time I ever emceed a concert. I knew how to make my voice sound like I was a man, but I was a boy. And there was a concert, a local jazz concert in Philly. And when I walked out on stage, everybody laughed because there was a boy coming out on stage, and where was the man's voice? And it was even sillier when I got behind the mic and tried to be who I thought I was. But it was a great time. Jazz was really at the height of what it was going to be in the modern era. And it was a time in which you could learn so much. I want to talk a little bit about how being on radio affected what it is that I really wanted to do, which was to be a record producer. I don't know about now. We had a phone in the studio, and you could call in and talk to whichever disc jockey was on duty at the time. That phone probably is where I learned how to produce records. The impact that being on radio had for me, and the reason that I still feel connected to radio, even though it's a different kind of jazz radio today, is because those listeners at that station with that telephone were kind of my education. You know, you play a record, the phone starts ringing. Well, why does it ring? There's only two reasons. I love it or I hate it. Sometimes there's a question, what did you play last Thursday? We didn't know what we played in the last hour, you know. It was a bunch of guys who just brought records they dug and played them. It was very, informal. And also for people who were really technically challenged like me, there was a turntable and another turntable, a mic switch, and a volume control for each turntable. If you got lucky enough to have a guest to do an interview, then there was a place where you could plug in a mic, and then there was another volume control. So even somebody like myself, could run it. We had to get, do you still have to get FCC licenses to be on the air? We had to go get a license where you had to pass a test that a chimpanzee could pass. I mean, I never saw a test like that in my life. Are you breathing in and out? Yeah, all right, yeah. You are now a third-class radio operator, and we used to carry them around, Anyway. Oh, so, the people. I always wanted to be a record producer from the first time that I realized that there was actually somebody who did something other than sing or play an instrument or something, and it affected, or engineered, and it affected the outcome of a record. And I started writing Atlantic Records when I was 14. I heard a Ray Charles record one night. My parents had gone to New York to see some shows, and my brother and I stayed with my grandmother in West Philly. And I was listening to WDAS AM. Was it 1480? Yeah, 1480. And there was a guy named Georgie Woods. Georgie Woods, the man with the goods. And he played a record at 9:15 on a Friday night in March of 1956. And the record was Ain't That Love by Ray Charles. I don't know what happened. I never had a musical experience like that in my life. It felt like whoever was driving the planet put the planet's brakes on for a second and then hit the gas again, I was gone. So I went looking for Ray Charles records the next morning. And there were none of them in the regular places that I went. So then I went to the black neighborhoods that had all those great shops that had R&B and gospel and, jazz. And there was a place called Paramount on South Street in Philadelphia. It was run by a guy named Felix, and he had listening booths. And he grew to hate me because I would come on Saturday mornings and I would just listen all day. And then sometimes I would buy a record, a Dixie Hummingbirds record or a Joe Turner record or something. But I had worn out all the samples, But I would sit in that store and I would listen to what everybody was listening to. And I would gauge reactions. And then I wrote a letter to Atlantic Records. I'm a little out of whack here, but I wrote a letter to Atlantic Records asking not only, for certain records I couldn't get, but for a job, and I was in 10th grade. And I started to practice to be something that I was going to be, and I didn't know what it was, but I knew being a disc jockey would maybe lead me to being a record producer. They didn't even call them producers then. They were A&R men. And when I got on the radio, I really learned what people liked and didn't like. I would go to the clubs all the time. There were three clubs in Philly. But that telephone was unbelievable because in the space of an evening, I was on the air for 3 hours, sometimes four, you would get 75 or 100 phone calls. And the comments people made and what they reacted to and didn't react to and all the different kinds of people you met, it's where I formed what I thought records should be in terms of what is it people wanted, I don't think I was actively doing it when I was on the radio, but as I look back, looking back now, I know exactly what happened, but even when I first started to produce records, we would be doing something in the studio with anybody, like the jazz guys, Les McCann, Fathead, Eddie Harris, Rahsaan, Youssef, and I would remember something in a record they had made that I had played on the air, and what the response was, and I knew it was something that could evoke something in that category could evoke a response. Or there were certain kinds of grooves or beats or lyrics or something that people responded to. You would get a record that was going to be a smash, and you'd know in 10 minutes you'd have 20 or 30 phone calls. What was that? What did you play? Like that. So it was really an education for me. And when we were driving up here, and I said to Kevin, they didn't want a bunch of funny stories, because most of the time when guys my age get together at these jazz things, someone will say, well, tell me a Rahsaan story, or tell me something about this, or tell me something about that. And they're great, and they're fun, but everybody here is involved in radio. And I know nobody does it because it's a way to make $1 million. There's not a way to make $1 million and be in jazz radio. So everybody here is a lover. And I wanted to try and relate my own experiences to you guys because it was another world back then. I don't really know what radio's like now. I don't travel much, and I don't get around. My connection with radio is Dick LaPalme. We speak every week, and sometimes he's working our records, and sometimes he isn't. But he's the last guy standing that I talk to. There are other people who do it that, you know, tell me, well, you know, I spoke to so-and-so in Shreveport, you know? Or there's a guy, a weekend guy in Billings, Montana, and he's playing so-and-so. And it reminds me, once again, of the radio experience because back then there were promotion men. Like, I would talk to Dick, or Dick would talk to me once a week, but I'd get calls from him at, like, 20 to 2 on a Tuesday when there were 8 people listening, and he'd be working a record. And there were other guys, you know, well, guys, oh, they're all gone. Guys like Juggy Gales, you know. Does anybody here remember Juggy Gales? All right, you guys remember, you know. These are guys, there was a breed of promotion men. There was a world where you were in touch with the record companies, with the promotion people, with local distributors. You know, there are no local distributors anymore, but in a city I grew up with, in Philadelphia, radio and record distribution were really tied together. And you worked hand in hand with the distributor because their lives depended on whether or not they sold the records for the different labels that they represented. If they had I remember Atlantic had a policy. They had two labels, Atlantic and ATCO, and they never gave the same distributor both labels. They would always have one distributor in each city that had Atlantic, one distributor in each city that had ATCO. And the only way they could keep the lines, and there were dozens and dozens of independent labels back then, the only way a distributor could keep his line was if he got results. So there was always somebody nipping at your heels, you know, the local guys. There were 8 or 10 local promotion men in Philadelphia. And it was also a part of the education, because when that kind of radio and that kind of record company, that kind of distribution, when all those things disappeared, the local aspect disappeared. There wasn't a guy in, you know, Chicago. There wasn't a guy in Detroit. You know, there are committees and it's something else. I don't really know what it is, and I don't want to listen. I'm still mad that the Dodgers. I was telling Nick before. I'm still mad the Dodgers left Brooklyn. So I'm not a guy to sit here and, you know, do a, you know, a great opening of you know, hands across the sea to what's happened to the record business. But I can tell you that whatever is left of real jazz radio, it's like a rare thing, and it's a beautiful thing because it, you know. Money is not the motive. You know, it can't be. There's no way it can be. Money's not the motive with the record companies, the major record companies in New York. The second it gets a little, you know, scary in the record business, the first thing they get rid of is jazz. It's like something you fall in love with for whatever reason, generally when you're young. And then you're hooked and you stay with it and you spend the bulk of your life saying, geez, if it would just get more promotion, or if people only heard, you know, Lester Young or whatever the lines are, it would be great. You would see it would be more popular than whatever it is, you know, that isn't. But the fact of the matter is that it's not. You know, it's like people who like Corvairs, you know. It's a small club, you know, but the people who like them love them. You know, I read car magazines, and I see they have a Corvairathon in Elkhart, Indiana, and then, you know, 861 people come, and they exchange pictures and stories, and, you know, guys show you their engine, and it's chromed, and I'm happy for everybody, you know. And jazz is kind of like that. And I don't only make jazz records. Like, right now I'm working on a Bobby Darin CD and DVD. It's got nothing to do with jazz. I love it. Next month, I'm going to start a gospel record. But I got this, like, permanent soft spot for jazz, mainly because of the years in jazz radio. And the other thing was, jazz radio back then, we had 3 clubs in Philly, which meant there were 3 big-name acts working Philly 51 weeks a year. Christmas week, nobody worked. So at any one time, you could have Miles, Nina Simone, and Mongo Santa Maria. The next week, it would be Cannonball, Horace Silver, and Gloria Lynn. The next week, it would be Lionel Hampton, Count Basie, and Ramsey Lewis. The next week, it would be Ahmad Jamal, Jack McDuff, and Wes Montgomery, you know. And I got to meet all these people and see all these people. And they would come to the radio station. I mean, being on the air was a tremendous leg up for me to meet people. When I left the radio, when I went to Atlantic, I already had like five or six people that I took with me. Eddie Harris, Les McCann, Rahsaan Roland Kirk, Roland Kirk at that time. We brought Fathead back, Hank Crawford, Ray Bryant, all these people. And most of them that I signed and started with were because of the radio experience. I would play a Les McCann record, and I would say to myself, as only a young, dumb guy can say, wow, I really know how to make a record with him, you know. I had all my secret plans, you know, the plotting and scheming follies was in full gear. But when I got to Atlantic and I did it, but it all goes back to the radio. Now when I put together, like, reissues, I do a lot of Atlantic reissues for Rhino, and we've done a lot of compiling and you know, tapes that were never out and stuff like that. The way that I still listen to anything that I want to put together is the same way that I listened to it when I was on the radio. You can hear certain things. You're never a civilian again once you're on the other side of the net. I mean, once you're on the radio, you're not a casual listener anymore. You're not a guy who puts records on in the background. You're involved. When you leave radio and you go and you produce records, you no longer have radio ears. I know I didn't. The second I got off, I was making all the mistakes that everybody that I listened to records by and thought I wouldn't do if I ever made records did. Does that make sense? Because I know what I mean. There's another way you listen to stuff depending upon where you are. Right now, I concentrate on tapes that have never been put out before. I have stashed thousands and thousands of hours of music that was recorded non-professionally or illegally, and then we make them regular. I do box sets, I do compilations, I do reissues, because the one thing that's missing for me is that old scene where you find talent. The bell doesn't ring for me like it used to. There was a time when there wasn't enough time in any year to record all the people that I wanted to record. Now, every once in a while, something comes along that makes me want to step away from a box set, which is easy to make, you know, because if you lived back then, you remember, you know, it's like assembling a puzzle you've done 100 times. It's not real tricky, but they're fun, you know, and you can write liner notes and get pictures and, you know, get a paycheck, and it's cool. But finding new talent is hard for me because I'm so stuck in those radio years when you would wait for the next Cannonball or the next Horace, or, you know, Les McCann would come along with a vocalist he found named Lou Rawls, and all of a sudden somebody's off and running again. And when I'm looking at Dick, and I just remember all those Ramsey Lewis records I used to get, and Ahmad Jamal records, and Oliver Nelson records, and Bunky Green records, and people you don't even, you know, remember anymore, but there was a constant flow of stuff, you know. Now, for a guy like me, there isn't. I get accused a lot of times of not getting involved with new talent. It's really hard for me because the radio station days set the tone for the bell in my stomach, and it only rings when it rings. You know, I can't fake it. So in the last 10 years, I've only made 3 new albums. Percussionist and lunatic named Leon Parker, who's a brilliant, brilliant artist and a difficult child to deal with, but a brilliant artist. A girl named Jane Monheit. And just this year, I went back in the studio for the first time since Jane Monheit with Frank Vignola and Joe Ascione. We have a record called The Frank and Joe Show. And I'm back doing what I did like 30 years ago when I joined Atlantic. I'm like out on the road. We're doing in-stores. I'm shaking hands, kissing babies, making promises, you know, doing all the kind of stuff you do when you have a record you believe in and, you know, you, like, got a chance to get into the fight again. So I don't know if what I'm telling you makes sense in terms of what your radio experiences are or how you feel about being on radio now, but to me it's a rare experience to be able to take a music that you love, you know, like, well, like with Clear Channel and Congress and the ozone layer and everything else everybody's worried about, it seems hard to have like a platform where you can sit down and play what you want, you know? I talk to Dick a lot of times and he'll tell me, you know, about the weekend guys, you know? And there's always some guy in Sault Ste. Marie, you know, who has like a big band hour or somebody who's on every third Tuesday or whatever it is for 45 minutes. But these guys keep it alive, you know? I don't know who they are. He tells me names. Dick will say, you know, in Wyoming, I don't know him, you know. Well, he loves you, you know, and he plays Fathead every week or something like that, you know. And I'm saying to myself, like, man, I'm so glad I went through the radio thing. And I don't know what I would do now. You know, if I would go back on the radio, I'd probably play the same records I played then. You know, it's like a frozen moment for me. But everything that I've been able to do is a consequence of having been on the radio and knowing that there's like a handful. It's like, you know, we're not at the, you know, the Pepsi Arena here. There's not 15,000 of us. There's a few tables full of people. So even though, you know, it sounds like blowing smoke, you know, I salute you for like staying with it because I know it's not easy. I know the first thing to go is jazz, and I know, you know, there's a lot of other stuff that's happening out there that takes precedence over this. But you guys keep this stuff alive. You know, you're here in Rochester together. You know what I'm saying? Everybody came to Rochester. You know, it's like, where are you going? We're going to Vegas. Oh, I can't wait to go to Vegas, you know. Where are you going? New Orleans. I love the food. We're in Rochester. You understand? But there's enough people that love this music and dispense it and keep it alive. So when I asked me to be up here, I said, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. I don't know if it's going to make any sense, you know, and I don't know anything else, by the way. But I know, you know, that maybe next year this group will be smaller, you know? So for whatever it is you're doing, thank you. I mean, personally, because you guys have kept me in business for a long time. But non-personally, just for staying with it. It ain't easy being green. I really appreciate your time. Thank you. One other thing. Thank you. You got any questions? Does anybody have any questions? If you don't, it's cool. All right. I figured I would save some hallway time.
Why aren't there any more traditional A&R men or women?
They just don't call them that now. The A&R, I'll tell you about A&R departments at record companies. They're these committees of people who know everything about music, and each company has one. When I think of an A&R, A&R people now, I think of that expression, a giraffe is a horse designed by a committee. That's kind of what it is. It just doesn't exist, but it does exist.
But the A&R man would take an artist and nurture them through two or three albums until they...
There are people who do that, but not in the way that you think. There are groups of them now, you know, and there are guys who do that. The other thing, it's the same thing with a different name and a different time. All right. Thank you. Oops, wait a minute.
Not a question, Joel, just a request. One Russ on story.
All right, I've told this one before. I told this one before, but it's my favorite one. I forget which album we were making. How we would work together is he would come in and we'd make all the music. And then I would take the music and form it into an album for his approval. He wasn't always there when we mixed the records, but if he was in town, he came often. And when I did mix them, I would have to send them to him for his approval. He wasn't working for me. You know, he was Rassan. So anyway, one time we had a mixing session for an album, and he was able to be there. So he came in. Hey, Ra, hey, Joe. Ho, Ro was rolling the hey, Ro, hey, Joe, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he said, sit in the chair. Hey, Carl. He said, sit in the chair, right? So I sat down in the chair, and he had lots of masking tape. He used to tie everything together. He had like 30 pounds of stuff he used to carry around. And he was always pulling some masking tape out of his mouth and wrapping it around a whistle and then, you know, French fried potato, whatever he had. He had millions of things he would keep on him, right? So he had these big rolls of masking tape. So in those days, I had long hair and a long beard, you know, and I'm sitting in the chair, and all of a sudden, he grabs my head, and he starts wrapping the masking tape around my head. You know what? So I was wrapping the masking tape around my head, and he really wraps my whole head like, you know, the mummy, right? And I got, like, a place to breathe and a place to talk, but not a big place to breathe, you know, and really not a big place to talk. I said, so what are you doing? He said, just shut up. I said, okay. Then he used to carry a starter pistol with him. Yep. Everybody thought it was a real gun, and he had these three canes hooked together with a wheel on it, and he had a starter pistol tucked in between the three canes. And he one time got arrested going on a, we had to pay off a congressman. He got arrested getting on a plane someplace because they found the starter pistol was back in hijack times. Anyway, I'm sitting there. All of a sudden, I know what a gun feels like. You know, my head is wrapped in tape, and I got a gun in my temple. And he said, mix the record. Now, I knew he wasn't going to kill me, but it still wasn't the way you want to start a day. So, you know, I said, what are you doing? So he made me sit there for like a half hour, and we were actually working and mixing, but he didn't take the gun away from my head. And finally, I felt the gun go away, and then he started taking the tape off, which was horrendous, you know, when you have like 2 pounds of hair. I said, what was that about? He said, I want you to know how I feel all the time. Is that a good enough story for you, Brad? Thank you.